Okay, very good. All right. So we talked about last time with Exodus 32, just what a sad picture that it is, as most of the book of Exodus is God delivering the people, God establishing a covenant with them, or God telling them to build a tabernacle. And the people in the middle of all of that respond by building a golden calf to worship themselves. You'll notice in verse 8, I wanted to bring up something from last time. In verse 8, how long does God say it took them to engage in sin?
Quickly.
In when the story is retold in Deuteronomy 9, in verse 12 and in verse 16, that is the same word that is used. They fell away quickly from serving the Lord. Now, if you look in Judges chapter 2, Judges gives kind of a... Judges 2 gives a little bit of a summary at the end of chapter 2 of kind of the nation as a whole and some of the things that we're going to see throughout the book. And what the book of Judges presents, the author of Judges presents, and specifically 2 and verse 17, is that the story of Israel at the golden calf is really the story of the nation during the time period of the Judges. So 2 in verse, Judges 2, 17. Tommy, I think we're up to you. Can you read that, please?
Yet they would not listen to their judges, but they played the harlot with other gods, and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in, and obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do so.
Okay, very good. So just as Israel in the wilderness turned aside quickly from the commands of the Lord, so Israel, once they enter the land, turns aside quickly from the commandments of the Lord. The story of the golden calf is typical of Israel's story throughout much of the Old Testament. And the sad reality is that it even can be our story. Remember what Paul says to Galatians. He writes to the Galatians and he's concerned about them. He says, Galatians 1 and verse 6, I'm amazed at how quickly you're turning away from the Lord. It's sad to think that we can follow in the same footsteps that Israel did in Exodus 32, that Israel did in the book of Judges, and that they did throughout their whole history, and even some Christians in the first century did. But let's pick up here in verse 15. And Moses is getting ready to go down and see the people. And what is he holding in his hand? Okay, you'll notice that they're written on both sides. And these are written by who? Verse 16.
The work of God.
Okay, work of God. Finger of God. Now we saw a reference to these back in chapter 31 in verse 18 as well. So it's emphasized that God is giving these commands. He's giving them orally, first of all. He's giving them in written form. Okay? And so that is emphasized twice. I want you to notice the contrast with Moses on the mountain and with Aaron down below. As Aaron in 32 in verse 4, what does he receive from Israel? Okay, gold, and notice it says he took it from their hand. And then what does he do? It is made into an idol there. Now, in 32 in verse 15, Moses is up with God on the mountain, and he takes these things that are written by the finger or the hand of God. So we have a contrast in which God that we will serve. Moses has been spending time with the true God, Israel creating a false God below. And as he goes down halfway the mountain, who is waiting on him? Okay, so this is interesting. Remember chapter 24, how far does Joshua go up? Okay, midway. So about midway up the mountain, he's Moses' assistant. And what is his response in verse 17?
He thinks they got a battle going on.
Okay, Now, we can look at this verse and say, well, oh, Joshua, he's really naive. I love this verse and I love this picture. And I think that this verse illustrates probably why Joshua is chosen to be the leader in place of Moses. He hears commotion in the camp and he assumes that it's war. Now, let me ask, has Israel fought a battle since they came out of Egypt?
Yeah.
Okay, where? Okay, Exodus 17. And our military commander in that case was Joshua, right? Not only that, but they had been attacked by the Philistines. They were, by the Egyptians. They were scared to death. They thought that they were going to die. And God fights for them. God saves them, of course, in that particular context. But they faced war before, in other words. So it's not unreasonable that he would think, okay, well, we're facing war again. And also, as we said in Exodus 17, his job is the military commander. He is up there on the mountain and he doesn't want to be neglecting his responsibility that God has given him. Now, I want you to contrast that with Aaron. Exodus 24 and verse 14. What's Aaron's job? Don, what's his job?
To take care of the people and watch over the people while they're Moses
away. Okay, well, close. In Exodus 24 and verse 14, go ahead and read it for us.
He said to the elders, wait here for us until we return to you. Behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute, let him go to them.
Okay, whoever has a legal matter, let them go to them, or a dispute. So they're supposed to be leading in the ways of the Lord. And Aaron has completely dropped the ball in that. He's not doing the task that he is given, that the Lord has given him. He is doing something else. He is actually leading the people away. As a matter of fact, look in verse 25. Brother Macon, read that for us.
32:25. Now when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them to be ashamed among their enemies.
Okay, Aaron is not doing his job. He's not interested in doing his job. He's not even attempting to do his job here. And you've got Joshua who's up on the mountain and he doesn't want to be neglectful in anything of the Lord. What a beautiful picture that somebody is eager at a moment's notice to make sure that they are ready to do whatever it takes to fulfill their position to serve the Lord. Ready at the drop of a hat. And Moses' response to him is, well, actually, this doesn't sound like war in verse 18. It sounds like worship. And in verse 18, he says, I hear the sound of singing. Now, I want you to think back in the story of the Exodus. Story of the Exodus. What is the last time we saw Israel singing?
When they were delivered down the Red Sea.
When they were delivered in Exodus 14, in Exodus 15, they respond by singing. Of course, you remember in that particular context, Moses begins the song. Moses and the sons of Israel sang a song to the Lord in verse 1. Then in verse 21, you have Miriam that leads all of the women in the singing in that particular case. So singing is connected with the great victory of the Lord. And so you take the great victory that God has given you and you praise another God with it. Remember what they said about this particular idol. This idol did what?
Brought them out of Egypt.
And so they worshiped the God, this God, with the same devotion that they had previously worshipped the Lord. Again, a major problem with idolatry is we attribute to God, we attribute to false gods the things that only God has done. Now, in verse 19, I want you to ask who Moses sounds like. Moses comes to the edge of the camp. He sees the calf. He sees dancing. And what emotion does he experience? Okay. His anger burned. So just as God's anger burned, so also Moses' anger burned. What does he do with the tablets that are in his hand? Okay, he throws them down and shatters them. And I think that's symbolic. You know, in my mind, I would think, oh my, you know, he shattered the handwriting of God. But in this story, I think it's symbolic of the fact that they have, what they have done to the commandments. They have broken God's commands. They have broken God's instructions and God's laws. And so because of that, he symbolically throws these down, and shatters them. So he responds like God. Let me tell you something I mentioned Sunday night. It's something that I think is an important theme of the Bible. We become like what we worship. And that is for ruin or for restoration. And Moses has been spending time with the Lord. And because he's spending time with the Lord, the things that make God angry are what made him angry. And he responds in the same way that God does. Opposite story told in 2 Chronicles 19 in verses 1 through 3. As Jehoshaphat is rebuked for something that he does because he loves that which God hates. But worship should make us more like the God that we serve. And perhaps, if we're not becoming more like Jesus, it's perhaps because our worship isn't as focused and as devoted as it needs to be. Now, in verse 20, he takes the calf, and I want you to notice where he throws it first. Throws it where? The fire. Now that's going to become important because of something that's going to be said in a minute, okay? He throws it in the fire, alright? So then after he throws it in the fire, what does he do with it? He grinds it to powder and then throws it into the Israel's drinking water. Deuteronomy 9 and verse 21 gives a little bit to me clearer details about that particular, this particular story. But Deuteronomy 9, 21, he throws it in the brook where Israel drinks and they have to drink it. So it's going to be a constant reminder of their sin there. Now, Moses then goes to Aaron, and as we talked about last week, it's kind of hard to understand a little bit Aaron's position in all of this. But in verse 21, he comes to Aaron, and he says, "What did these people do to you to make you give in?" And I think that's an interesting way to ask this particular question. He assumes that, you know, something went terribly wrong, and I think he's trying to give Aaron the benefit of the doubt. He says, "What did these people do to you that would cause you to bring such a great sin upon them?" You see, the leader takes responsibility for the sin of the people, or at least is given responsibility. Now, I want you to notice Aaron's response, and I want you to connect it with some of Moses' actions, first of all. But I also want you to contrast it with the way that he responds, with the way Moses responds to the situation, okay? So Aaron says in verse 22, "Well, don't let the anger of my Lord burn." Now, first of all, that sounds like Moses actually talking to God. That's what Moses said to God. You know, don't let your anger burn. He's trying in that moment in order to turn away God's wrath. So in verse 22, what does he say about Israel? I am glad Aaron wasn't on the mountain with God. Because that is not one who's going to intercede for the people. Moses' response is, God, remember how that you brought us out of Egypt. Remember your promises of old. Remember all of these things. Aaron is, yeah, well, you know them. They're just wicked people. Well, what are you going to do, right?
Sounds a little bit like Saul.
Okay, why do you say that?
Well, when Samuel went to see him, and you know, when he came back and supposedly destroyed the Amalekites, Saul started making the people wanting to do this. You know?
Okay, that is good.
They wanted to save
yeah.
the best of the flocks, you know, and that, you know, and here goes the discussion, and it's like, why are we having this conversation? You know, Samuel's incredulous, Moses is incredulous. Both of them are.
Yes.
That's a similarity.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right. You know, you've got the one to blame the people in 1 Samuel 15. So you're exactly right. Where else, while we're on that particular train of thought, where else do we see someone...
Adam.
Okay, Adam and Eve, right? Adam, did you eat of the tree? Well, this woman, you gave me. Eve, did you eat of the tree? Well, it was the serpent. He tempted me. And then God starts with the serpent and then pronounces a curse on all of them. So he plays the blame game, but he kind of downplays the sin and downplays the fact that they're wicked. You know, Moses' response at the end of the chapter is what? What? How does he respond?
Outraged.
Okay, he's outraged and, you know, he's going to go to God to ask for forgiveness. Yeah. Aaron's response is, you know, what's the big deal, right? So he is not interceding for the people, and thank goodness he just pictures them as evil. In verse 23... he gives a pretty good description of what happened in the previous verses. That's pretty accurate, almost word for word, to the story. People did say, we don't know what happened to Moses who brought us out of Egypt. We want a God. And so in verse 24, Aaron's response is, well, I told him to give me gold. And then in verse 24, what does he say? Okay. Now, how are we to interpret that statement, verse 24?
If it weren't so serious, it would be funny. I mean, when we read that a minute ago, I heard somebody laugh. And I kind of laugh when I think about it, too. But it's really serious.
Okay, so there's a sense in which we recognize the humor of this, right? I mean, things don't accidentally form by themselves, right? I mean, we don't just take a bunch of items and throw it, and then boom, you have something created. I wish that's the way it worked, but it is not. Anytime you create things, it is a struggle, right? So there's a humorous element to it. There's also a sad element to it. But you notice in verse 24, what did he do with the gold? You know, that is the same Hebrew word that is used in Exodus 32 in verse 19 to describe what Moses did with the tablets of stone. He threw them down. Then what does Moses do with the golden calf in 32 and verse 20? He throws it into the fire. Now, maybe I'm wrong here, and if you disagree, I'm not going to be upset with you. That's fine. But I kind of think not only is Aaron downplaying the sin of the people, I think he's trying to say, in not so many words in verse 24, well, I really had no part of this. You know, I was just like you, Moses. You were mad. I was mad. You threw down the tablets. I just threw the gold to get rid of it. You threw it in the fire to destroy it. I did the same, but I'll pop this calf. What are you going to do?
Yeah,
he forgot the altar there as well. But it seems like he's trying to present himself as he was trying to stand against it the whole way. Have you ever seen the episode of Andy Griffith where it's Founders Day and they bring somebody into the town? They're going to first visitor in the town. They're going to make him the guest of honor. Well, of course, the first visitor is a pickpocket. And of course, there's all types of things that start falling apart. But at the start of the episode, Andy's the one who's come up with this idea. And Barney, you know, he'll say an idea and everybody in the town council, they're clapping and cheering and they love it. And Barney says, "That's amazing. That's exactly what I was thinking." And, you know, every time Andy comes up with a good idea, he says that like three or four times. And then at the end of the episode, when things are going downhill, it's Andy and Barney sitting alone, and Barney says, "I tell you what, I was against this whole Founders Day thing from the very start." And that's the way that we often are. We present ourselves as we were the lone person trying to hold back the evil, trying to hold back the wickedness, trying to stand in opposition to all of this. But the reality is, as Martha pointed out, there's several hints that Aaron was not doing that. And as a matter of fact, in verse 24, he is the one who is blamed for letting them get out of control. Just as in Genesis 11, confusion results as a sin. So in Exodus 32, confusion results because of sin.
Nathan, it's interesting that earlier he said that he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made it. Now the story's changed.
You're exactly right. I mean, there's something he does in verse 4 in order to make the idol. And as Martha pointed out, he makes the altar. He raises no objection at all in building this. He's the one who tells them to donate their gold earrings. So, I mean, it's a sad picture, but it is a picture of how that we often respond to sin. And it's a picture of the consequences of sin here as well. And the confusion that results. Now, in verse 26, how does Moses respond? What does he call the people to do? Okay. And what command does he give them? What are they told to do? Those who come. Yeah, those who are for the Lord, you're right, come. And then what does he tell them that they're supposed to do? So whoever's involved, go through. How many end up being killed?
3,000.
3,000.
So it sounds like to me, and this is difficult to see how they ascertain who got killed, but every tribe was affected because they went to the gate of every camp. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there was no tribe that was left untouched. The question is, how were the 3,000 selected? I guess that's the question.
I've got a few ideas.
Okay.
Well,
I like these.
Well,
because I mean, they could have, in theory.
Nothing kosher.
In theory, they could have killed every one of them.
Numbers 25.
Okay.
You have when they're engaged in immorality.
Yeah.
So that is one particular instance. Obviously.
Yeah, that's a clue, but all of them were engaged to some degree. But
yes.
How many? Was there more going on that was demanding something beyond just?
I think that there probably was even more than this 3,000 who were involved because of verse 35, the Lord smote the people. How exactly were they selected? I don't know. Like I said, I think Numbers 25 is a hint. I think, you know, there's other things that they might have been doing as far as worshiping, you know. Let me look at 1 Corinthians 10. I wasn't intending to bring that up. I wasn't, because we've talked about that before. Let's see. 23,000 fell in one day. Now, there is, I think in Numbers 24 it says 24,000 fell. So some people have questioned if Paul is kind of sandwiching together those two stories. He's telling both stories and just kind of talking about that, because that number is specifically named. But you're right. I mean, verse 7, 1 Corinthians 10, 7 specifically references 1 Corinthians. I'm sorry, Exodus 32. I'll get my book straight eventually. That is debated, whether verse 8 refers specifically to that or to the event in Numbers 25, because he seems to be jumping to stories. Verse 7, Exodus 32, verse 8, Numbers 25, verse 9, Numbers 21, 9 and 10. But that's good. There's a little debate about that.
But the plague doesn't say what God did.
It doesn't. And what's interesting to me is when the story is retold, Deuteronomy 9, the plague is not mentioned, which I find interesting. Of course, not every time is a story recorded. They record the whole thing. They're just recording sometimes highlights for things. But that is interesting that is just told us in Exodus 32. So he tells them to rededicate themselves to the Lord in verse 29. The Lord will bless them. What does Matthew, I think we're up to Kaylee right here, Matthew 10:37. What does that tell us about how we are to regard our relationship with God and our relationship with family? Well, if you feel called to read some others, go ahead.
He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me.
Okay, so what is our attitude with our relationship with God?
More important.
It's more important. It's more significant. And anyone who loves family more than the Lord is not worthy of the Lord. When Jesus' family comes to him, Matthew 12, verses 46-51, that's probably wrong. What does he say who his family is?
Those who follow him and his father,
basically. That's right. 46-50. Yes. Who are my mother, my brothers? He who does the will of my Father who is in heaven is my brother, sister, and mother. To me, that's a great comfort to know. I have family in the Lord. It's a great comfort to me. Okay. But they are an illustration of one who chose God over family, and we are called, of course, to do the same. Now, what time frame are we dealing with the story in Exodus 32?
We haven't been at Mount Sinai long, have we? And that only took, 3 months?
Okay.
Are we just 3 months out of Egypt?
Okay. Now that, I was asking a slightly different question. Yeah. So Exodus, I think Numbers 9 is when they hit the year mark. Okay. But look at Exodus. I'm looking a little bit more for how many days transpire. I worded that badly. Let verse 32 in verse 5 and 6, Debbie. What time frame are we given here?
In Exodus
Yeah, Exodus 32, 5 and 6. What I'm asking is, in Exodus 32, how many days transpire with this story? So at the end of verse 5, when will we have a feast of the Lord? Tomorrow. Okay, so Exodus 32, 1 through 5 are day 1. Okay, then verse 6, Joel, what's that say? That's our next day. We're on day 2, right? All right. So, Martha, we're back up to you in 32 in verse 30. What day is it? The next day. So how many days have transpired? 3 days. Remember in Exodus 19 when they were told to get ready for the Lord? How many days were they told? 3 days. And you'll see the Lord. They were to spend those 3 days doing what?
Getting ready.
To purify themselves. So how do they spend these 3 days? Defiling themselves, right? So how do we prepare for the possible return of the Lord? By preparing ourselves or by turning away quickly and defiling ourselves? And so 3 days, 3 days have passed. And notice in verse 30, we have what type of sin has been committed. Tom, verse 30.
Big sin.
Marissa, verse 31, what type of sin has been committed? Okay, Moses is not pulling any punches. It's a great sin. And so what is he going to do? It's time to go back up to ask the Lord if he'll forgive. Now, what was the reason at the beginning of the chapter? People said, now this Moses, he's been gone too long.
Leave again.
And now he's going to leave again. You know, if we were businessmen, right, we would, well, it's not a good time, need to stay with the company, need to, you know, Moses says, no, this is urgent. I need to be back with the Lord, and I need to be focused on asking for forgiveness from him, and forgiveness for the nation. This is a great sin that has been committed. And so he goes to God, and he asks, God, if you will forgive. Now, what is powerful is what we'll see, what God reveals about himself in Exodus 34 and verses 6 and 7. God's graciousness, God's compassionate. Now, in Exodus 32 and verse 32, he says, God, please forgive these people. That's a little bit different attitude than, well, you know, these people, they're wicked, right, that Aaron had. Forgive these people, and in verse 32, if not, do what? Okay, blot me out of the book. Now, probably going to upset some people here. This is probably not a reference to the book of life that is contained in the New Testament, okay? This is the same word that is used in Genesis 6 and verse 7 to describe the destruction of people at the flood. It's just to describe death. The book he's probably referring to is the book of the living, right? God, spare these people, take my life, in other words. I will volunteer to be the replacement for their death. And the same word is also used Exodus 17 in verse 14 when it talks about how that the Amalekites will be blotted out forever. That's Exodus 17, 14, if you want to jot that down. Or if you have a good footnote, maybe it'll have that. So this just seems to be, what he's offering is not, you know, take my name out of the book of life, send me to hell, but allow me to die in the place of the people. Now, if you instantly hear that, I hope you immediately think about Jesus. There's a reason that Jesus is a prophet like Moses, because he was willing to offer himself on behalf of the people. And God says, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of the book. I will make these decisions, Moses. But he says, go back down and tell the people that who will lead them. Okay, now I want you to notice as the chapter began, what did the nation of Israel want? An idol to lead them. And so God, in effect, is saying, no, just as I have led you before, so I'm going to continue to lead the people. Again, what is one of the problems of idolatry? We turn down the wisdom and the guidance of God for wisdom, for earthly wisdom that leads to our own destruction. Let us not make the same mistakes that Israel made, which is the whole point, as Martha has brought out of 1 Corinthians 10. What else jumps out at you as you look throughout Exodus 32?
In my version, in verse, and I was wondering what you said, in verse, the last part of 29, after they do the day you dedicated to the Lord, each since each man went against his son and so forth, therefore you have brought a blessing on yourself today. That just doesn't sound like the rest of the chapter. I mean, here we've got so much going on. Grave, mine says grave sin. And grave to me is that this. And it was that close. And so, but this, you keep by correcting your mistakes or repenting and turning and obeying, you brought a blessing.
Yeah.
You said they were blessed from this.
Yeah.
The Levites.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is going to be one of the reasons that God chooses them. Yeah, that's right.
The account in Deuteronomy says there that the Lord had intended to kill Aaron.
Yeah.
And Moses interceded for him on the mountain, praying for forgiveness for him.
Yeah. Deuteronomy is, of course, I think you can gather that from Exodus 32, a little bit of reading in between the lines. But Deuteronomy does specifically say that, and that is a sad picture.
Don't you? That's probably one reason Moses returned back to the Lord. It was urgent.
Oh yeah.
It was urgent. He gets back up on that mountain and gets on his knees for the Israelites.
Yeah, there's definitely an urgency, and I think that there's really a picture in Exodus 32. Of what sin is, how it angers God, how God in his anger still is willing to show mercy and grace, but just how serious that it is. And there is just chaos and confusion that emerges when sin breaks out. Verse 25, I mean, the people are just out of control. And that is just such a sad and pitiful picture for God's people. I don't know. All right. We'll try to do. Wait, do we have.